One. Welcome back, everybody, to the Quill and Query podcast. My name is Brandon Hall. As always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today? A little stressed, but we're gonna get through it. Yeah, it's okay. I just have a undying habit of taking too much on and not taking anything off. So.
And also, hello to everyone in the chat who said hello.
Nicole, hello. Michael, I always forget how to say your name. I'm sorry. I think it's Michael.
Remember that correctly? We're so bad. It's been a minute, but we'll get there. Yeah.
All right. Well, we have a exciting show for today. We have some fun topics to go over. We're going to talk a little bit about writing under pressure, and then some more topics kind of relevant to what Ash and I have been doing lately, like beta reading. And then we have some fun topics like our bookish pet peeves that we're going to dive into today. But before we do all that, we're going to go into our reading update that we always do to let you guys know what we are currently reading. So, Ash, what are you currently reading?
I've shifted away from some heavy, serious magical fantasy to more cozy fantasy. I'm reading an ARC review of a book that came out last week, actually, called Impractical Magic by Emily Grimoire. That is not her actual last name, but I think it's such a fun pen name to use if you write like spooky rom-com romances. Yeah. And then, yeah, I've just been slowly working through the Blades for Hire betas, beta reading.
Yeah. That's actually honestly been all my reading this past like week plus has been reading the wonderful story submissions for Blades for Hire. Those of you who have been watching that project, we pushed it from summer to hopefully holiday of this year, just to give everybody some more time to work on their stories, myself included. But yeah, there are some wonderful stories in there. I have had the pleasure of finishing a few of them now, and they are just as good as I was hoping they would be. So super proud of everybody for all their hard work. And I'm only like a third of the way through, I think, all of our authors. So, and I think some are still waiting to submit. So plenty more good stories to come, but we'll be sharing updates on Blades for Hire as they come. But that's probably going to consume my reading for the next 2 weeks as well.
Yeah, so I know.
Expect the same update probably on the next episode. As far as podcast updates, I'm just going to start saying this every episode, but we have a guest form now in our link tree. So if you want to be a guest host on Quill and Query for a author interview and you want to talk bookish things with us, that should be right in our link tree. That's in our Instagram and TikTok bio, I believe. If it's not, let me know. We'll fix it. But yeah, we have some guest applications already, and we're looking to get a few more. So if you have an upcoming or recent release, especially, we'd love to help you promote that in some way. So if you're comfortable on a podcast, maybe check out our guest form. No audience questions this week, but we do have some indie releases to spotlight. So I'm just going to get into those real quick. We have Into the Embers by Destiny Guyton, published this week. I didn't get a date, but you can find it on Amazon. You can buy it right now. Also, I just wanted to say, Destiny, if you watch this, I really liked your cover. It's really pretty. One of my favorite indie book covers so far, for sure. Then we have The First of Their Kind by Lalonda S. That actually comes out today, October 8th. So check that out as well. We have Black Bones Jones by James Moore, October 10th. And then lastly, we have Academy of the Dead by Vermilion Bane coming October 11th. So a lot of like back-to-back releases this week. Be sure to check those out. I'll be checking out some of those as well. But yeah, I think that's all the updates that we have. So, and all our indie releases. So I guess we can dive right into our indie publishing and book discussion. We got some fun topics here. I'm just trying to catch my breath from that long-winded update for you guys.
No, that's okay. Also, hi, Megan. It's good to see you again.
Megan.
Some folks in the chat this week. Exciting.
Yeah, we love having our live audience. It makes it a little less, you know, monotonous from week to week when we have people in the
chat
engaging.
When it's just us talking at each other.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, the first topic we're going to get into is small press publishing. So I've been seeing a lot of people talk about the pros and cons of being published by a lesser known publisher. This is something that admittedly I'm not very well researched on, and I meant to rectify that before this episode, but I ran out of time. So I was curious though, Ash, I think you might be a little more knowledgeable on this topic than me, and I don't want to make any promises for anybody. So I'm sorry if I'm setting you up for failure there, because I was just hoping that you might be more knowledgeable on this than I am. But do you have any thoughts on these smaller publishing houses and things like vanity presses and that just any publishing group, I guess, that would be not considered under the big five or the ones that people usually refer to when they're talking about traditionally published authors?
Yeah, it's really interesting you had this as a topic, because I know a little bit, but I don't know maybe more than the average layperson, but actually don't know that much about the small publishing space, only from the interactions I've had with when I did earlier this year. I did like the writing event near me and got to meet a couple of smaller publishing folks. I think, you know, when we talk about like the big five or the big publishers, like they all started off as really small independent publishing houses. So I think it's always nice to not exclude those in your look for publishers, especially because I feel like smaller publishing houses, they want work. They want to publish work. Granted, it does make it harder sometimes because they are very niche. Or they can be, and so it can be a little difficult if you're publishing just kind of like, you know, a broad swath fantasy or whatever. But from my experience, they seem to be really eager to have people, not in a way that seems exploitative, but just like, oh yeah, we're here to uplift smaller voices, and we're not trying to, you know, be Tor Books or Penguin Puppy, whatever. I think vanity presses are interesting. I don't really know enough about them, but I feel like there have been a couple moments, and I don't think these count as vanity presses, but there will be like, hey, if you pay to have your thing published, like $75, we'll put it in our magazine that goes out every quarter. And if you're really interested, this is a topic that I have been thinking about recently, but if you're interested in expanding your body of work, it can be useful if you want to just get your name out there. I think that's honestly why a lot of people are doing the anthology, because they're like, oh, this is collective of people who have only published once or twice or never published. So we want to get our name out there in a way that we'd like to.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of a lot of detail, I don't really know that much. It would be really interesting to circle back to this topic maybe in the new year after we've done some research. Also, let me know if you can hear like the cars running by. It's like beautiful outside, so I have the windows open. If it gets too loud, please let me know. So yeah, I think they can be really useful. I don't think there's any initial danger with at least small publishing houses, especially if you do your research on who you're trying to pitch to. I think that's usually the best advice you can really give anybody, is just do your research. Like, do your research before doing it. Look at reviews, ask questions, and don't sign anything until you've had someone else look at it.
Right.
But yeah, that's my feedback.
Yeah. Real quick, thanks everybody, especially Megan, for the likes and the shares. And yes, Nicole, I think you shared and liked as well. Thanks just everybody for the likes and shares. We love to see those. But yeah, those are all interesting points. You definitely sound more knowledgeable on it than I do, so I appreciate
that
your insight.
Sound that way.
Yeah, <'Cause I'm> well, it's interesting. So I've heard of vanity presses before, and I think the concept of paying to be published is interesting to me, because to me, I would really have to see like the metrics on what am I getting out of paying for this, as opposed to just self-publishing and doing the marketing myself. I think that would be an important thing for me to include in my research on these smaller publishing houses, because that's something I admittedly right now, like if I was offered that, I would immediately turn it down. I would not want to pay someone to publish for me.
Yeah, right.
So, and it's interesting you bring up the anthology, because that is like, that was kind of the mindset behind creating it as well, was, well, I see all of these kind of quieted creative voices, and I feel like I'm a part of those as well, so I want to make a project where we can elevate those all together. And so if that's like where those kind of presses are coming from, then that makes me kind of reevaluate what I thought they were doing initially, which sounded very predatory to me. And I'm sure there's some instances of that anyway, like any industry. I guess just to me, the thing that comes to mind is if I was running any sort of publishing house, is I would want to be the one selecting what gets published, and I would want to pay people for that, not take money. I feel like there has to be some measure of quality control then, because I'll have to research how they do that, because immediately what jumps to mind is what's controlling the stories that are getting chosen here, because is it just you pay and then you're published, or is there a little more that goes into it?
Yeah, it varies, and that's why I think it's really important to do the homework. So my partner wanted to publish his own, he's a photographer and a cinematographer, and he wanted to publish his own photo book, so he was looking into presses that would help him do that. And photo books are very, very niche, so this is very separate in that regard, only because art, like physical art, is just a different kind of niche genre. And its publishing world is very different. But he got, someone reached out to him and was like, hey, like, we would love to publish your book. And then when he looked at it, it was like he would have to front 70% of it, and there would be a deficit if he didn't sell all of the copies, and there was a copy minimum. So they're out there. The ones that you are referring to, they are out there. If someone is saying you need to front the cost and then we will help you publish it, I would much rather people go and self-publish on their own with their own resources. That way you have full artistic control. I guess when I'm thinking of small presses was, I'm so bad, I'm blanking on the name of her, but a really small publishing house that published like rom-coms and like cozy fantasies and like memoirs and things like that, but it was like a legitimate publishing house. So I think the ones that we are interested in, they are out there, but you kind of have to look through the muck and the mire. And another thing too is a lot of magazines will, like me back in the day when I used to try and publish poetry, you'll have to pay to have the people read your poems to be included potentially, right? It's like, hey, there's a $20 fee that you pay, but when you do that, you also get the magazine or the press or something like that. So there is like a monetary thing there, but for a lot of these smaller like magazines, they do need the money from the people who are submitting, whether or not they'll get chosen or not, to be able to continue to do that and give prize money to like winners of competitions and things like that. But they're not necessarily exploitative in that regard. And you often you get like the annual subscription paid for if you send in your $20 to submit. So it's a little more complicated than I think a lot of people realize. There's so much nuance to it that isn't just like, it's a small press, so I can't trust it, or something like that.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like there's a lot more nuance than even I was aware of. So, and also I think I focused like really heavily on vanity presses. I wasn't trying to limit small publishers to just that. I know there's, because I follow some smaller publishing houses on Instagram and whatnot. And they seem perfectly legitimate, not predatory by any means or anything. So, I hope I didn't misconstrue that.
But. No. I think sometimes they are inexorably intertwined.
Yeah. Well, speaking of kind of unorthodox publishing methods, I wanted to talk a little bit about Kickstarter for indie authors. I know that some people in our kind of book talk circle have had really successful Kickstarter campaigns for funding big projects like audiobooks, special editions, you name it. So I was just curious, what are your thoughts on this as a writer and a consumer of books? How do you feel about both like indie authors utilizing Kickstarter to fund big projects like this, and then also about bigger authors like Brandon Sanderson has also done quite a few very successful Kickstarters. And so what are your thoughts on this, and is that a route you could ever see yourself going for a future project?
Yeah, I actually really like the idea of Kickstarters. Holly Black just did one because she wanted to create a multiplayer card game based off of her book series, The Folk of the Air. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really fun. It's taking something that maybe the publishers have zero interest in fronting the money for, and bringing something to fans and to readers that maybe is not in their reach. For big names, it's, if you're a huge fan, of course you're going to be like, yeah, I want to buy the special edition for this Kickstarter or the comic book. I know a few of them like do comic books that, you know, again, their publisher doesn't have any interest in or want to work with independent indie artists. I think that's really fun. I think as long as it is meant to come from a place of like, we're doing this for the fans and not to pay my bills, that's when I'm like, yeah, absolutely, 100%. In terms of indie Kickstarters for self-published or indie publishing authors, that one gets a little strangely nuanced for me, and I can't exactly pick out why. I think we kind of talked about like serials as well, like serial releasing a book serially. And I think if you're going to be an independent author and try and publish via your Kickstarter, you really have to up the ante and offer your fans a lot in return. And I have seen people do it so well and just be like, if you help me kickstart this book, you get this massive poster, you get a signed copy, you get this behind the scenes Patreon access to my writing process, and all what you get like a lot when you give your $40. I think unfortunately a lot of people also don't do that. So it's if you're going to choose to give your money to an independent author, you need to make sure it's going to the right place and worth the money, I guess, if that's what I think. Because some people can't afford it, but they're like, the story means so much and they've created a great fan base and, you know, people are interested enough to warrant that, and then that's perfect. But they can get sometimes a little exploitative if you're like promising all this and then the quality is either not there or just like never happens. But you publish your book anyway, and people are like, where's all my extra stuff that I wanted, you know?
Right.
I think there's a bit of a danger there.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the things I really like about Kickstarter projects is that immediately you can see if there's a demand for something.
Yeah,
And so
it's a good gauge.
It's sometimes it can be heartbreaking in that regard, I imagine, for the non-successful ones, but it's also a great way to see if a project is even worth doing, really. Mm-hmm. So like if you are an indie author and you're thinking about doing a special edition, for example, and you do a Kickstarter and it exceeds your goals, then you can automatically see right there, like, oh, there's a high demand for this. My fans really want this.
Right.
And so that's one of the things I like about it, is that it kind of takes away a little bit of that business risk. And as long as you have a good, transparent relationship with your fans and you're providing, you know, equitable rewards in return for the tiers, I think they can be really great. I think also there are a lot of, especially not, I haven't seen them in the book space as much, but like in the video game industry, for example, there can be a lot of shady projects. So definitely like be cautious about the ones you're backing, make sure it's an author you trust. And make sure you're getting your money's worth, because it's still a product that you're purchasing at the end of the day. So you should feel like you're getting what you paid for. It shouldn't feel like you're donating to pay, like you said, pay someone's bills. These are to fund the projects and then give them to the people who expressed the interest, really. So,
I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's just got to be worth it. And I've paid like $40 for a couple of Kickstarters for like art books, like collective of a bunch of different artists with a central theme, very much like an anthology in that regard. And it comes in the mail and I'm like, oh, like that was a lot of money for this.
Yeah.
Like it's shorter than I thought and the quality is fine, but was this really worth $40? Of course, because I want to help artists who want to get their work out there, but you know, sometimes you can feel a little let down, or there's just no transparency, as you mentioned. I think that's a good word of just being like, hey, it's this many pages, it's this size, it's this, whatever. And then when you're like, okay, yeah, all right, I'll throw in $40, or you know what I mean? So,
yeah,
it can be sticky sometimes, but it's also like, see if the interest is there. If you've got a website and people hit up that website all the time and they're always asking for more, then I think you know that you've got a good project on your hands.
Definitely. Well, the next topic I have for us is kind of a follow-up from last week. We talked a little bit about a view that both of us disagreed with, I think, but the view that self-publishing is not a valid form of publishing, or that you can't call yourself an author if you're self-published, and similar similar lines of thinking. And I think we disagreed with like the overall way that was phrased, but we acknowledged some rightfully placed concerns about like the quality control when it comes to self-publishing. Like the good faith part of that argument, if I guess you could say. But I kind of wanted to follow up on that and get your thoughts on what do you think are some good ways that someone who may be thinking about self-publishing can kind of avoid that stigma of being the low quality indie book or presenting a, you know, a quality product to somebody and not falling into that stereotype.
I don't know if anyone's going to like this answer, and it sounds so very just like, ugh, but you just can't even worry about that. Like, you can't, it shouldn't be something you worry about. Yeah. I think that's in the ever-changing, ever-shifting world of internet discourse. It's just, if you have to prove to somebody that the work that you are creating is worth their time and effort, then that's not the person that you need to be wasting time on.
Yeah.
There's a difference between being like, is the story something that's going to interest me, the reader? Okay, tell me about it. But if you're then having to shift the argument to, well, that's not actual writing, that's not authorship, that's not publishing, that's not the audience. They don't deserve your time or your energy. And it sounds, again, it sounds so simple and kind of just like whatever for me to say, but it's also the internal fight, because the minute you let somebody cause or plant that seed of doubt in your mind, you're giving that energy instead of your project. It happens to me. I mean, it's just, oh my goodness, I'm gonna close the window, sorry.
That's okay.
I just thought I could get away with like really nice fall breeze, apparently not. But no, I think that would be my advice. And you know, if you do find yourself like really wanting to fight, let's say if you want that argument, if you want to change people's mind, I think coming at it from a place of teaching is a better way. If you give the other person who disagrees with you the kind of grace that they are not giving you and turning the question back on them, it can be beneficial. You know, if you go, okay, well, then what's your definition of publishing? You know, like, seems like we have a difference in opinion there. What are you think? And then you can kind of delve into curiosity in that regard, right? You know? Oh, so it sounds like, you know, this is what you're thinking of publishing. Well, what about this example? And then that kind of just starts like an open-ended conversation rather than trying to prove your own self and your own worth. And usually people who want that argument want you to get riled up and heated.
Yeah.
So you keep it calm and collected. Usually they're like, oh, they're not going to fall for this. Okay, well, now I have to back up my beliefs.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's as simple as that, and then their whole thought process falls apart. So I think if you want to go that route, it's better to come out with kindness. And if they continue to be jerks, you just, I guess it's just not going to change your mind, and that's okay, because you're not the reader for me anyway, you know.
Yeah. It sounds like Megan and you are kind of on the same page about, she says she agrees with approaching with the teaching mindset and then also supporting, rating, and recommending any indie authors you love. I think that's a great point too. If you can point to you know, good examples that kind of go against what they think of when they think of a low quality self-published book, for example, if you can kind of dispel that notion with real examples, not that you have to by any means, like Ash said, like you don't need to engage with that method of thinking, but if you're trying to kind of persuade someone to enter the indie space as a reader, that could be a great way to do it, is show them books that you think are of a good quality. And I think I just have a natural desire to prove myself anyway. So I think I approached this topic a little differently from you, which is nice. I like when we do that. But some of my thoughts just were kind of like what I just mentioned about reading, like point to the examples of why this isn't the case. And I think Like, for example, me, if I am going into publishing A Knight of Knives, for example, and I do self-publishing, I'm going to highlight, you know, all of the work that went into it, the editing, the money I poured into it. Not that that equates to quality, but I think those are important things to highlight if you are trying to have that conversation of like, well, just because it's self-published doesn't mean it's not edited. Just because it's self-published doesn't mean we didn't hire a cover designer who knows the industry. Like, there's all these things and different layers to self-publishing, and not even saying that people who don't do those things write bad books by any means, but just leverage what you put into your book, because you put in a lot of effort and time, presumably, to write something. So if you are trying to kind of engage in that conversation and not let someone just dismiss it because it's self-published, come in with those things. Like, yeah, I spent this much time writing it. Like, I didn't just churn it out in a week and not edit it and put it on KDP and things like that. I think that's just kind of my mindset is, like, if I was in that conversation, I would want to a certain extent, to dispel, like, their preconceived notions about what self-publishing means. I guess that kind of goes with your teaching mindset, though.
No, I think they definitely merge and mesh together.
Yeah.
And I think you pointed out a really good, you know, you mentioned, like, just because it's self-publishing doesn't mean it hasn't gone through editing, doesn't mean it hasn't, you know, you haven't hired somebody to edit for you. I think there's this big misconception around self-publishing that it's, and often it is just the person self-publishing, but there are so many layers to it. It is hiring someone to edit if you're interested, or learning to be an editor, which takes its own time and its own effort. And this isn't for everyone. Obviously, like, some people don't even care to edit, and then they just, like, put it out because they just know that some people will read it, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think people forget that it's a lot of time and energy and work that oftentimes, when you get to a big publisher, and this isn't saying that it's not hard work for the people who get picked up by big publishers, but, like, you're not designing the book cover. You're helping make decisions, but you're not sitting there on Adobe, you know, whatever, trying to make it work, or you're not saving up money to get all of this out there. So I think coming at it from a place of, like, the title self-publishing is really misleading sometimes, because it is the self, but it's not just the self. It's so much more than that. And I think when people are trying to come at you and just be like, well, it's not publishing, they don't realize they are attacking the work of somebody who has worked very hard, regardless of whether or not you think it's good or not.
Yeah.
But they have worked and put the time and the effort and energy into something that, when you ask the other person, what have you done? Have you built anything? Have you written anything? Have you created something? And it's a no. Then it's like, well, then I can't relate to you, because you don't know the time, the love, the energy, the sweat, the tears, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think just coming at it from a place of teaching and then knowing when to just walk away from an argument is
is
important, you know?
Yeah, completely agreed. All right, well, we're going to move on to our writing discussion topics for the week, but we do have some good news on the work in progress check in front. One of us more than the other. But Ash, how is your writing going?
It went well. It went well these last couple weeks. I'm excited to say I finished the short story on the last day before it was technically due.
Better than me.
Look, greatness takes time, so I totally understand. Yeah, so really stoked. It's like just over 20,000 words. So in a couple days, I wrote over 10,000 words, which if you guys want to know how long it takes me, it takes all of the extended Lord of the Rings edition movies back to back for me to write. All three of them.
Insane.
And a little bit of the first Hobbit, but then I kind of turned it off because I can't stand the whatever. Anyway.
We should dive into
CGI. That. Just too much CGI. I'll leave it at that. I like the old Lord of the Rings. But yeah, so that's how long it takes me. I think that's like 12 hours or something like that. Anyway, super exciting. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I didn't give up because I wanted to so many times. And I'm really excited for everyone's feedback. It also encouraged me and lessons learned about hyper planning, which I think we talked about last episode. My therapist being like, maybe you just need to be someone who's an extreme planner. And in doing so, practicing with this short story has made me realize, unfortunately, I have to be someone who really, really, really plans. It just went so much faster, which seems such like an obvious, silly thing to a lot of people. But when you live your whole life thinking that you are one way, yeah, and you get shown to do another, it can be a little discombobulating. So anyway, that is, I'm excited to edit and kind of get back into the planning process for A Filthy Hunger. So, yeah. What about you, Brandon? Give us some good news.
Yeah. Well, I have about 10,000 words written in my Blades for Hire story, but it's nice. Not done. So I can't share it yet. And the way I have it written is like each part is still missing a good chunk. So I can't even share like part one with anybody right now.
Okay.
Just because it's, I kind of like, I know I said I don't do this much, but I am doing it with the short story is where I bounce around a lot. Because of how short I'm running on time, it's like if I'm stuck on one part, but I can make progress in the other, I'm just going to do that right now. And so that's kind of where I'm at with the Blades for Hire story. And then also a lot of the free time I had this week, I devoted to beta reading.
Because I did
want to get everyone their feedback kind of as soon as possible, even if it was just an overarching kind of couple paragraphs on how I felt throughout the story overall. But yeah, congrats on finishing your story.
Thank you. But also, that's behind you. You're so close. You are truly so close. And I think, you know, you're like, I don't normally bounce around, but for this one, I have to. I'm like, my learning, I need to plot differently. Is definitely just like learning how to go with the flow.
Right.
And that can be really challenging sometimes. You're like, no, I don't normally do it this way. But sometimes the story warrants you jumping around and the other requires much more meticulous linear storytelling. So yeah, I'm excited to finally read it. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, hopefully it lives up to hype.
I don't even know what it's about. That's the thing. You're like living up to the hype. I'm like, you're so secretive about your projects, which is fair.
Well, that's because I did
but
change.
I'm only this just one. Excited to read it.
Yeah. So I changed because originally I was supposed to do the Night of Knives prequel, which didn't work out. I still want to tell that story at a later date, just not right now. But I switched stories and then I did heavy rewrites in this story. So
yeah,
it's. I've probably written over 20,000 total, but the amount I've cut has drastically brought that down because I've moved the plot around. Some things weren't feeling right to me. So it's just, I'm a hyper perfectionist, but, but I mean, I have a deadline. I got to meet it. So even though I'm already late, but you know, I think the deadline we set for final edited stories was, I think, end of October, early November. So
yeah,
I'll definitely make that. It's just, the initial deadline I'm pushing.
Yeah, I'm honestly glad that I got it done personally, like right like on the 30th, because I needed to step away from it. I was like starting to go back and like start to edit down stuff, and I was like, no, I just need to get everyone's opinions, whoever wants to read it, you know, the group in beta. I just need feedback on like what to fix, what not to fix. Your feedback already was like super helpful. Megan, yes, to answer your question, for those who don't know, Brandon kind of kickstarted on his own an anthology called Blades for Hire, and I and a few other peers and friends are writing short stories for it, so it'll be out soon. Be out hopefully by the end of the year or springtime, but deadlines for it came up recently, and then by like end of October we all need to have them fully done. So I'm excited to get the feedback so I can go back with fresh eyes and good perspectives. You gave great feedback also, so yeah, I totally feel that. Just needed to not stare at it.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the free marketing offer, Megan. Thank you. So this, just to go off of what Ash said, it is a fantasy anthology. The theme is mercenaries. We have about 14 or 15, I always forget exactly how many authors contributing. Some of our book talk circle, like S.M. Campbell, Bex Gill, and others that you are probably super familiar with. So another thing about the anthology is all of the profits, if any, will be going to charity. It's a book-related charity. It has been a while since I've been on their page, so I gotta double check what their like mission statement is before I misquote it. But it's ultimately about improving like literacy in children and providing books to kids with you know, less access or not as privileged access to books, and just kind of spreading the love of reading to as many kids keeping as back. Possible. Yeah. So super fun project. We originally planned to have it out in the summer, but we just wanted to kind of take the time we needed. Everyone was kind of feeling a little stressed out and rushed with the summer timeline. And mm-hmm. it's been a great learning experience to like figure out how a project like this, you know, works. So we're all just kind of taking it one step at a time.
So exciting. It's super great. I keep telling everyone about it. I'm like, I like did the short story for an anthology that's coming out. And most people are like, so what's fun. An anthology? I don't know what an anthology is. They're kind of like not as well known, which makes it very, very cool. But
And I'm doing so much fun stuff behind the scenes that's also eating into my writing time, but like designing the PR boxes and all of that.
Yeah, you are doing so much. It's crazy. I'm like, I'm like, please give me more. And then like doing the social media stuff for this, I'm just like not doing. So
it's all good.
I say give me more and then I don't do it. So anyway, no, you're a true trooper and a true leader in this regard. You are doing it all. And a new dog. And you've got Nova, right?
She's actually sleeping right now, but thankfully. All right, well, that covers our work in progress check-in. A little longer than usual, but that's okay, because we're behind schedule anyway, so no worries. Speaking of the anthology, I wanted to talk a little bit about writing under pressure. I think this is a topic we kind of come back to regularly, because we always have, like, something new to say on it. And I thought it would be fun to explore now that, like, I was hoping to have my story done by now so I could have some more insights to it, but yours is done. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how writing under pressure kind of affected that process. Because I know you and I have both kind of been very transparent about the unfortunate reality that we both seem to work well under pressure, even though we don't like that fact. I was curious, like, just walking away from your completed short story, do you have any new insights about like how you work under pressure, how to take advantage of it, or anything else? And do you have any advice for anyone who feels in that, like they're in that same boat as us?
I I'm going to start this off, and it's going to seem kind of crazy, and I promise it ties in. So okay. A few months ago, I think it was back in February, actually, I listened to this podcast about procrastination. And scientifically, procrastination can have like a pretty big impact on your health. If you are constantly thinking about the deadline, it causes you stress. You're in fight or flight mode more consistently or for longer periods of time, which can, of course, eventually affect your health, your heart, your brain, whatever. Knowing this doesn't change the fact that I think that I work better under pressure now. To me, for a very long time, pressure and procrastination were the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think I've learned in this process that both are different. And that seems obvious. I know people are probably going to listen and just be like, yeah, obviously. But for me, procrastination and pressure have always been the same. Like, I'm under pressure to complete this thing, but I've waited this long. And so they kind of merge. I think for me, learning about my outlining process and then the actual writing process itself, I think I enjoy a tight deadline. I like landing on the fact that I need to get this done by the 30th of September or else I will be behind and this is not allowed. And that wasn't the case, because when you were like, if you need a couple extra weeks, like no big deal, there was so much flexibility. But internally I realized that once that deadline was set for myself and it was like the 30th, I couldn't allow myself to move past that. So it seems all over the place, but I learned to separate the two, that pressure and procrastination in my mind and what works for Ash are very different. And that procrastination isn't the best move, but pressure is. So the pressure I put myself to have it done by the 30th was a good thing for me. And unfortunately, that meant that I did procrastinate and I waited too long. But the date... No, ma'am. Sorry, one second. She's whining and I can't stand it.
It's okay.
No. Down.
Thank you for all the gifts, by the way, Megan. I just noticed those.
So, yeah, a lot of this was learning how to differentiate between the two. Once I realized that the plotting really, really helped, the writing process was so quick. I just waited so long to do it. Going forward, I will be much more aware of, all right, you've got this much time to plot. and smaller time to write because you realize I do better work under pressure, but you shouldn't wait until the last 2 days before your self-inflicted deadline to do that. So anyway, I hope that made sense.
Yeah, I follow.
That's what I learned. What about you?
No, I actually really like your insights into like the separation between procrastination and pressure, because I think I still kind of tie the two together.
Yeah.
In my own mind, where I work better under pressure, so I'm gonna procrastinate so that I create more pressure or something. Correct. Along those lines. And I'm really trying to move away from that. And mm-hmm. I think hearing you talk about it a little more kind of helped me separate the two in my own mind. So that was super helpful. But I just kind of the same thing where I've tried to set mentally my own deadline, even if I'm giving myself some flexibility just because there's only so many hours in the day. Mm-hmm. But trying to have like, okay, I didn't make the September cutoff, but I know I have to make the October one because otherwise we're not going to release in time. So yeah. Having that in mind, like I know that's a lot more rigid. I can't pass that. I won't let myself mm-hmm. pass that. Even if it means I have to reevaluate how I'm writing, like maybe plot some more like you did, or you know, whatever it is.
Or not be such a perfectionist, which ended up being a big thing for me too. Because towards the end, I was like, you made a note of it in the feedback you gave me. It was like, in certain areas, there seems to be this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And I was like, yeah, it's such a good call out, because I was doing that in order to get it done and on the page. But if I had given myself extra time and not procrastinated, there might have been less of that. So that's a good point. It's just like, sometimes you also need to throttle back on your own sense of perfection to let it just come out in order to reach your deadline.
Yeah. And that's kind of how it came through during reading too. And that's something I've always struggled doing in my own writing, is like understanding that it's okay to have that in like the first draft. Like it's totally fine to have it read that way. As long as it's not like, you know, I feel like if it's the entire thing, then maybe you have some other issues to work on.
Sure.
But that's something I'm trying to, like, as I was reading it in yours, I was trying to make a mental note, like, see, it's okay to just get the words on paper sometimes and worry about like perfecting the prose after the fact.
And that's honestly, it's the like number one piece of advice that everyone gives everybody. Like, mm-hmm. just get it on paper and get it down, and you can edit and add later, but then you have the best framework. But then when you go to do it yourself, it is almost impossible to do.
It's
because
really
you don't want to put forward work out there that is just kind of there. But then mm-hmm. some people are like, you know, I know. But here you go. Like, I'm going to just edit the heck out of it. I just need someone to see if this is working correctly.
Yeah.
And it's all about the balance there. It's like, yeah, you want to have a good polished first draft so that the editing doesn't take so long and that you're not stuck for weeks and weeks, like, adding or taking away. It can be a simplified process. But yeah, I also learned that too. Like, it's just really challenging to let go of that. But once you do, holy cow, you get it done in 2 days.
yeah we'll see if I can take it to heart over these next
we'll check in a couple weeks.
Well, following up on kind of the feedback we touched on, our next topic is about beta reading and feedback, so we can
this was
jump
the question
right
I was
one.
Gonna add that
Ooh,
you
okay.
had already added, so I was like, dang it, he beat me to it.
Yeah, so I just wanted to go in, now that we're kind of getting into the beta reading stage of Blades for Hire, to talk about how you approach beta reading, both as a reader, because you submitted a story, but you're also providing feedback on other people's stories, and I'm doing the same. So how you approach it as a reader, and then, sorry, I lost my train of thought here. And then how you approach it as a writer, and what you kind of do with feedback in this stage, and what are you looking for? What kind of feedback are you looking to give? Just from the giving and receiving standpoint, how do you approach the whole mm-hmm. task of beta reading?
Yeah, so I got like halfway through beta reading Bex's.
Mm-hmm.
And before I had done that, I had reached out to her personally, and I was like, hey, I'm about to start beta reading your work. I've already kind of like put a few comments in there. let me check in with you and ask what kind of beta feedback you're asking. In my mind, beta reading is like, be as nitpicky, be as like hard, not harsh is not the right word, but be as critical as you can, because I'm relying on you for that feed. Also, again, sorry, she's on a different level today.
It's okay. I can't hear her in the background. Right now.
Okay, good. I'm just like always worried she comes through. It's the most annoying thing in the world. Yeah, so I was just like, because to me personally, I like a lot of feedback. It hurts. I am not good at receiving feedback only because we have the same concept of perfection, I think, of like, yeah, this must be perfect. And so when I present something that I think is perfect and someone doesn't, I feel like, I'm a horrible writer. That's obviously not the case. So it's more of like, this is such a good process and learning how to take genuinely good feedback. And like I said, in Bex's feedback on her story, I was like, these are all suggestions. You don't have to take a single one. And I think that's what a lot of people forget. So anyway, tracking back, I asked her, I said, what kind of feedback are you looking forward to? And then I ended up putting it in the big group chat. I was like, put a heart, this color, and this color, dependent on what kind of beta feedback you want. Because I feel like some people just want maybe just the positives of just like, this is really good. Like maybe reconsider this and that. But other than that, sounds awesome. Some people like me, and it seems like a lot of other people want you to like be as thorough and as like kind of like there with a looking glass being like, this needs changing. So I think if you are someone who enjoys giving beta feedback, always ask the person first, or at least get their requirements for beta feedback, because everyone feels different about it, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't want to hurt someone's feelings and you don't want to overstep. At the same time, if you are okay and you want and you say, be as brutal as you want, give as much feedback as you want, you have to be comfortable receiving it.
Yeah.
And that is my current self-practice of learning, is receiving that feedback, understanding it is not a reflection of who I am as a person, and it doesn't mean I'm a horrible writer. It's just, hey, I caught some things that, you know, need to be fixed. And for those of us wanting to be either traditionally published or you go to then self-publish, you know, it's necessary. You can't get away from it.
Right.
So that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I think with the mindset of like receiving really critical feedback or sometimes even brutal feedback, my mindset has always been, if this goes to like publication or if it went to a traditional publishing house, it would probably get a lot harsher reception, like whether that's in an Amazon review or from an editor at a traditional publishing house, like that those environments are going to be probably more critical and more brutal to some extent. And so if I'm not comfortable receiving that feedback, understanding that, you know, those, when someone's providing feedback on my story, it's not an attack on me as a person by any means. It's, and usually if someone's providing you feedback, they can see potential in your work, and that's why they're willing to put the time and effort into doing that. So also trying to think of it from that perspective is that like, if they DNF'd it in the first page, there wouldn't be feedback, you know, all the way through the document. It's so there's potential. You just have to make sure you kind of keep a level head when you go into feedback and understand that. I thought we got a chat. Understand that it's not personal. It's meant to help you improve. And in reality, your beta reading group is probably going to be nicer than the groups you could have. So. And then the kind of feedback you'd receive after publication, whether it's warranted or not, just
exactly. Yeah,
And I didn't really touch on how I approach giving it, but what I've been trying to do with Blades for Hire is, since there are so many stories, and since I'm kind of organizing everything, I personally want to read all of them before ghost publication. I know not everybody's going to read everybody's story just because there's so many, and that's totally fine. But for myself, I kind of set that goal of, I've got to read everybody's. And so what that's meant so far is sometimes I can't provide like the line by line feedback that sometimes I'm able to give, and sometimes I'm not. Like if I feel it's really important, I will, but I've kind of stepped back currently in my beta reading of these stories right now from doing anything that I think is like from the first draft symptoms, you know, kind of like what I touched on with yours is I'll touch on it in the overarching feedback I give, but I don't really want to go line by line and nitpick each example. One, for time's sake, but two, because there's a lot of things that I look at and I think that'll be fixed in editing. And so if I just touch on a few examples in my overarching feedback right now, that's kind of where I'm at. I do love to go in and give the line by line kind of feedback. I love doing it. It's just when there's so many stories to read, it can be a little difficult. So, but yeah, I think it's also important to know, like you said, what the person is looking for. Because what I've noticed is a lot of times, and what seems to be the case with most of these stories so far in Blades for Hire, is the things people are looking for aren't like, is my grammar perfect? And is the prose perfect throughout and all of these things? It's more like, is the character, or are the characters interesting? Is the plot... Is the plot good enough? Do you want to read more? And then, because when they're editing, they're kind of already working on improving the delivery of the story, so the prose and the grammar and things like that. So ultimately, they want to know that the bones, like you said, are good and strong. Mm-hmm. So what they build around that can kind of strengthen it. And because if there's structural problems with the story, those usually you want to address those as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. So. If there's something wrong on like a foundational level, I think that's what a lot of people, in my experience anyway, are mostly looking for. Like they still appreciate the more nitpicky stuff. I know I like getting the nitpicky feedback, but I think ultimately, so far in my experience, that's what most people seem to be looking for.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think the individual component is really important because it's like a big spectrum. It's do you want very little or do you want a lot? I think I'm currently working through Tyler's, I think it is, the squirrel.
Oh, yeah, he did the
squirrel story. It's so funny. It's reading very similar to Redwall, which I loved as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and he ended up being like, tear this apart. Like, go for it. So I feel like I got the ability. And I want people to know that when I'm giving beta feedback and I, like, you see a ton of like, I felt kind of nervous, like, commenting on Bex's because I was like, I really don't want her to think that I'm, like, hate-mongering or, like, being too nitpicky. But I love the story so much that I'm like, ooh, maybe here, like, it's just refining something that's already so good. And I think people who don't take feedback very well struggle with that, including myself to an extent. It's like, you're taking something that's already so very good, especially if everyone's like, no, this is a great story, like, but let's perfect it. It's like, you've chiseled out the shape, now let's give it detail and let's, you know, smooth it out and all this kind of stuff. So I always am like, oh, like, and I one of the big things that I give when I will preface certain things and say specifically, unless this is stylistic, could I recommend this instead? Yeah. So it's like understanding that you're going to have very different styles of writing. And even if you see something that's like maybe stylistic, but maybe not, then, you know, if it's like a repetition of a word back to back to back, you're like, okay, I can see that maybe this might be stylistic, but I'm not sure if you know that it's been repeated multiple times.
Yeah.
Potentially take another look. And if it is, ignore my comment. Like, that's totally fine. So, yeah, I think it's, you can't get away with not doing it. I mean, you can. I just don't, no one's a perfect writer. You know what I mean? Like, I think a long, long, long time ago, Sarah Dessen is like a young adult or an adult romance writer. And I saw a post on her Instagram a long time ago. And it was, I think it was like 7 or 8 massive stacks of paper side by side. And she was like, I'm on my 8th revision of this book. And each one had been printed out to go through edits. And she was on her 7th. And this is like back in the day, like a really popular, like preteens eating her stuff off the shelf at this point. So it's really humbling, but it's also so nice to know that even the people that you love, you know, I know he's canceled now, so please don't come for me. But one of my favorite quotes from Neil Gaiman is like, he gets asked, like, how does the story start and how does it look like now? And he's like, they're completely different stories. So, yeah. You know, it's just, you got to do it. And it's important.
Yeah. 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 Feedback is definitely important to any creative process. And I don't think it's healthy to avoid it just because you're, you know, potentially afraid of what you might hear.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to move over into a little bit of a fun topic today. We're going to talk about our bookish pet peeves. So we've talked in the past about DNFing a book, but mm-hmm. These aren't necessarily things that make you DNF. They can be, but mm-hmm. taking a break from the more serious topics, what immediately makes you like roll your eyes when you're reading and go like, oh my God, but not necessarily put the book down. But maybe push you in that direction.
Okay. All right. We're going to get into it. I have become way pickier, though. I don't know if it's just like an age thing. It's like you hit your 30s and you're like, I don't have the time anymore. Yeah. I admire people who never DNF books. I'm such a hard DNFer. And I think you mentioned this in the question, like not without the intention that maybe this is, I'm a mood reader. So maybe this just isn't the time for me. Like maybe this book isn't really hitting because I'm not in the mood to read Dark Academia or whatever. What will quickly make me DNF is opening with some cliche like mm-hmm. I woke up from a dream. Immediately I'm already like red flag number one. Yep. So that's a big one. Megan said I've been pickier since I started writing and editing. I think that's also a good point. I think the more you read or the more you write, the more you just like pick up on stuff.
Yeah.
So there's that one. The miscommunication trope. I know some people really enjoy it. And I think miscommunication should be in a book because this is, it's life. You're supposed to be reflective of life in some way. But if it like happens and it's just like the next 400 pages could have been stopped if you had just asked a simple question or like pushed back a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't have time for this, you know?
Yeah.
No way. So there's that too. If there is a lot of block text now, if you're not breaking up your world building with action or conversation or anything like that, it's just unfortunately not for me. World building is so difficult, but if you're really just like going on for 14 pages, it's kind of, no offense to the master of all masters, J.R.R. Tolkien, kind of does it. You're kind of like, this is like 4 pages of tree.
I was just about to say that.
And you read it because it's a classic, but I don't think in modern literature it is as necessary. Now, I did read in book club earlier this year or last year, The Secret History. And there was a lot of that in it, but it was from like an observational perspective. It was discussing the relationships around the main character, and it worked for the novel that was being written, but I had to stop reading it for chunks at a time because it was just so dense. So that's another one. I'm trying to think if there's one more. This is just for the Kindle Unlimited girlies, honestly. The surprise pregnancy trope. No. I will actually in the middle of it just close and put it down. No offense to the moms out there, that's not about the being, it's just my God, surprise. It's like Twilight, you know, when Twilight had happened in that, and you're kind of like, what, like you're 18 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. So those are my DNFs. I'm sure I'm gonna get some hate on some of these, but anyway.
Yeah.
What about you? What are your DNFs?
So they're not immediate DNF flags, I suppose, but they push me in that direction, and they're almost all character related. There's certain like character stereotypes I just can't stand.
Okay, all right, I like this.
One of them is so, and I think it's strange because I don't read a lot of romantasy, but I feel like they're more, and this is probably why, but I feel like these tropes are probably more prevalent in romantasy. But I do notice them bleed over into some books that I pick up that I was not expecting them in. And so some of those are like the, I really don't like an edgelord kind of super badass, like male character, like who's like very grim and foreboding. And like, it's weird. Like there's a way you can do it well, but like sometimes it feels like and maybe that's the intent, but sometimes it feels like someone wrote like their fetish of what a man is, like sure. what they want. And it also goes in the reverse for the female, where it feels like a male author just wrote their ideal partner as a character.
Yes.
And so, like, I think there's ways you can do things like that well, but when it comes off as like very I don't know what the right word is, like very juvenile, very like amateur, like
one-dimensional, it's just very much like I'm very similar with like the never knew I had powers female, and then she suddenly gets powers and she does a training montage and then all of a sudden she's like this phenomenal fighter. You're like,
yeah, that was another one I was gonna mention is like took it right out of my mouth, is the one that's like suddenly good at something that they have no right to be good at.
They pick up
the sword for the first time after never holding like a heavy object in their life.
Yes. Oh my god.
And they like slay 10 trained swordsmen.
Kill an army.
Yeah.
You're like,
it's so those kinds of things. I think the female kind of character stereotype I was referring to earlier, that's kind of like the inverse of the other one, is I feel like you've mentioned this one before, maybe it was someone else, but it's the like, I'm so small and innocent and like, or
the damsel
in
distress.
Yeah, it's
get out of here.
The helpless woman that like needs that other male archetype to come in and do everything for her. I don't like those characters either. Like there's so many more I could go off on, but like,
yeah,
it's just like characters who are very stereotypical and feel like. So we're getting the TikTok puzzle thing that I have to slide.
There's like a neighbor's dog that she's obsessed with.
That's okay.
And they finally like got into the backyard. So she's going, can you hear her?
Very slightly, but it's not like interfering with anything. It'll probably be like dulled down. I actually, that might be my dog that I hear now that I think of it.
Yeah. Do I go and just like let her out? But then she goes crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, and my partner's not here either to help a girl out. So.
Yeah, no worries. Anyway, but yeah, just characters that feel like very stereotypical, or like they're someone's ideal version of something, or like I said, that are suddenly good at something that they have no right to be good at.
It's like whittling them down to just something so easily undone. Like you're just making this their one personality trait, and it's funny because. Like, both of those are kind of similar to, what is her name in, is it Vin in Mistborn, Brandon Sanderson's, like, her first, like, she doesn't realize what she is, but she's also, like, tough and, but also quiet at the same time. Like, you can do it well. Like, you can do this, like, very innocent, realizes she has power and coming into her power and needs to help fight a war, but you gotta let it, like, marinate. It can't be a 40-page, here she comes, 40-page... That's it. It's really frustrating.
Yeah, the one-dimensional description is perfect.
Yes, exactly.
if there's depth there and there's more to the character than just that kind of surface level stereotype, then
it
doesn't bother me as much. It's just when it seems like that's their entire personality is.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm the cryptic dark, you know, foreboding guy who's always brooding, or you know, very all the ones I touched on already, but
yeah, absolutely. I fully agree.
All right. Well, we just talked about what makes us sometimes put books down. So let's go to what makes us pick them back up. Sometimes I think we've both talked about being mood readers, even a little bit this episode. And I think you and I both know the feeling of picking up maybe the right book, but at the wrong time. So do you ever find yourself putting a book down, maybe DNFing it and just being like, not right now, but I'm going to come back to this later. And what is that like? Like, does that happen often for you, or?
Yeah, it happens so often. I have, I think, about 7 laying around the house with bookmarks in them.
Yeah.
And same. I think one of my like little superpowers is that I can like after months and months pick up exactly where I left off and remember the scene that I'm currently in. Like I have a good memory. Like, oh yes, this is what is happening. So I've been asked that before, or like in just casual conversations with friends. They're like, dude, if I don't finish like a chapter, I have to finish the chapter even if I'm gonna fall asleep, because I won't remember where I left off. And I don't know if it's just from reading so much as a kid, but then you get yelled at for not doing your homework and then you have to turn back, whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm absolutely one of those people who have been like, it's just not hitting right now, but I'm liking it. Like, I don't hate it. I just, it's not for me at the moment, especially when I'm in like book ruts where I'm like not feeling any book I pick up just isn't really hitting. And that just means I need to go reread a favorite and then it'll kickstart a new era of reading for me. But yeah, I'm totally one of those things, because something can be so beautifully well done and like lovely, or it's been something I'm so excited to read, like a new author coming out with a book and it's a part of a series that I really love. It actually happened with V.E. Schwab's most recent book, The Fragile Threads of Power. I was so enjoying it, but I for some reason just like couldn't continue reading. And I realized I just wasn't in the mood for it. And that's the thing with like, it kind of bleeds into our consumer, hyper-consumer capitalist culture, where it's like, you must read the most recent and be able to talk about it and give a review within like 2 days of picking it up, or else you're not going to be relevant. And for a while, I fed into that like really, really hard. And then I would hound myself for not finishing fast enough or having to put it down because it just like wasn't compelling enough for me. And then I was like, oh, maybe this isn't my favorite. I mean, it just kind of, I also have anxiety, so can you tell? But it all kind of compounded until I stepped away and realized like books don't, there's not like a timer when you open it. So take your time. You don't have to read it immediately, even if it is your favorite author and it's a book that just came out. So I think once I like learned that about myself, that's why I have so many just kind of stacked around the house in random places. And then I'm like, oh, I want to read Babel. I haven't picked up Babel yet, so I'm going to pick that up and then close this book that I've been trying to read and add that to the currently reading pile. Like, it's fun. It's okay to do. I admire people who can just like read one and done and then move on, but can't like read multiple, because I'm like, I wish I could finish stuff.
Yeah, me too.
I can't really.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I have so many books lying around that have bookmarks in them, and I've even like ran out of bookmarks and did the, I know it's sometimes sacrilege, but the folded page thing. I know. Don't crucify me on here, but I'm one of those people who can have like 5 books active reading or more at a time, and like sometimes I'll have to restart if I stopped in the middle of a chapter. Sometimes I'll have to restart that chapter, but I rarely have to like restart the whole book. Usually once I'm like 1 or 2 pages in, I'm like, oh, okay, this is where we were at last time. Picking up like an in progress read and having multiple going isn't too difficult for me. It's very much just a mood thing, whether like I realize it's the right time for a book or not. Because I did say I'm a big mood reader, so sometimes I just pick something up and I'm like, this is great, but I can't get into it right now, so I'm gonna shelf this for later, because today I am in the mood for sci-fi, not epic fantasy. So and I'm the same way with like every type of media that I consume. It could be movies, TV shows, games. Like it's always a mood thing for me. I've tried really hard to get into the mindset of like sticking to one thing until I finish it. And I think I just enjoy things more if I take them as like I'm currently doing, where it's like based on my mood. Like, well, I really want to read sci-fi, so if I force myself to read this thing that's not sci-fi right now, I'm not going to enjoy it as much, because I'm going to be thinking about sci-fi the whole time. So, it's kind of just like that for me. Like, if I pick something up, I can recognize that it's great and put my bookmark in it and say, I'll come back to you later.
Yeah, 100%.
Usually, that's very different from a DNF for me, obviously, too. Because with a DNF, it's like, this isn't for me, or this isn't that great. So it's like the total opposite feeling, really.
I think it is interesting, people who like just straight up DNF, and I absolutely do the same thing. I will try a couple times. There's a very rare scenario where I do just like in the quarter of a book, just be like, I can't do it. And it usually happens with advanced reader's copies of stuff that I get from NetGalley, because I'm just kind of like, oh gosh, I just think this needs to be revisited completely, and it's just not, it's not even a mood thing, it's just something that I can't read. And I have pushed myself to finish books completely, like Fourth Wing is one of those that I was like, I got halfway through and I was like, oh, I just can't stand this novel, but and I was in the mood for it. And that's when you know it's like a real DNF. You're like, oh, I'm in the mood for like a dragon romantasy. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you get halfway through and you're like, but I finished it because it was so popular and I wanted to be able to give my full constructive angry feedback. And I couldn't do it if I didn't finish it. So there are moments, but they're less frequent, where I fully just straight up am like,
yeah,
I can't read this anymore. I'm over it. Yeah. Honestly, yeah. Like a lot of book talk recommended books, unfortunately, become those for me, which is why I've stopped taking recommendations.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp where I'll usually give something more than one try because I know I'm such like a mood consumer, I guess is the best word for everything. Like sometimes I'll watch something and I'll be like, I can't tell if this is like a mood thing right now. I don't know if I'm not enjoying it because of that or for other reasons. So I'll come back to it later. And then if I give it a second or a third try and it's the same feeling, then I can recognize like it's just not for me, or I don't think this is something I'm gonna enjoy anytime in the near future, so we're just gonna forget about it for now. But I had another thought to follow from there, but it's getting late and I forgot what it was.
I straight up thought today was Thursday,
and then well hopefully we'll hit Thursday soon and then the weekend, so
we're close.
All right, well it seems my train of thought has completely left the station, so I'm just going to move on to we're just going to move into our weekly writing resource. Now I know this is not, I don't think this is necessarily writing related, and I don't have one this week, but you have a very great kind of resource thing to share, so I'm gonna just let you have the give you the floor to share this wonderful resource.
Thanks. I think last week when I did like the nonprofit bookstore, I think we touched briefly that maybe we could do something like that going forward. But since our last podcast, a lot has happened in the world. And with Milton about to hit again, I just thought like maybe this would be helpful for people in general. So I'm asking folks, this is not like a necessary thing to do, but you know, if you're thinking about buying a book that's $15, but it's not a necessary book, maybe take that $15 and give it to one of the following, because after Helene, we've had friends who've been impacted and a lot of, I mean, millions of people. So Appalachia Funders Network is a nonprofit kind of like outreach program that's been created to help those in Eastern Tennessee and Western North Carolina that were hit by Helene. You can find them on Instagram. There's also the Humane Society of the United States is asking folks to try and foster dogs. Now, when this gets posted to like YouTube and Spotify, it will have already hit. But for the listeners listening now or in the future who want to assist, a lot of animal shelters need people to temporarily foster the dogs and cats and other animals in case they get flooded or hit. So if you're able to, if not, please obviously donate. I've put in the chat, and I think not in the chat but in our document, and I think Brandon is also going to upload it hopefully like to YouTube or whatever, but there's a master Excel list called the Appalachian Hurricane Helene Relief Resources, and it is a huge document full of where you can give, where you can go volunteer and donate. Currently there's only in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee, I think. I'm sure Florida will be added, even though it's technically not Appalachia, just because, you know, we've got a Cat 5. So, if not any of these, please just donate to one that you find that best suits you. But I think one of the great things about writing is that we can reach a lot of people, and it's, important now more than ever, I think, to help our community. So those are my helpful writing resources for the
No, it's still important, and I'm really glad you shared that one. So I will be sure that gets in the YouTube description for anyone who wants to take a look at the list that Ash has shared with me. Just really hope this next storm comes and goes, and everyone is safe. And because I live in a zone that floods very. I don't think I'm in the path of this coming storm, but just, you know, naturally during this time of year, there's sometimes where water is like up to my front door, and it's just, it can be scary. Insane. So,
scary. It's 100%. And if you have any community members that you know, that have been affected, you know, make sure to share their stories and get their GoFundMes or Cash Apps out there too. I know sometimes it can be hard. You're like, I don't know if this is legitimate or not, but you know, I think regardless, it's best to try and put your money and resources right again.
Yeah. All right, Ash. Well, I think that is going to do it for Quill and Query today. We do have a few guests still with us, so we're going to open the floor to you guys if you have any topic suggestions, any questions, any feedback for us. Now is the time. And you can always share on social media as well. You're not limited to right now, but you have our full attention right now.
I know, we're kind of early. We're like 10 about, minutes early.
Yeah, we're running a little early today. And I put extra topics in, so that's interesting. But we should hopefully have a few guest appearances for you guys soon. If you would like to be a guest on Quill and Query, and you didn't hear my spiel in the beginning, our Linktree has the guest form. So be sure to... Sorry, I lost my train of thought again. Be sure to fill that out if you're interested in being a guest on Quill and Query. We'd love to have you, especially if you have a upcoming or recent release. We'd love to help you promote that. Looks like we got a comment from Megan. I would love to hear about your experience with putting together an anthology and lessons. Definitely. I was thinking about exploring this probably closer to publication, either slightly before or a little after, just because I think then I'll have like the full experience under my belt, and we can definitely dive into that. And then Ash will have some unique perspective on that as well, like all of us who have worked on it, really. So, but yeah, thanks for everybody. Yeah. Thanks to everybody who joined us today. We got a ton of likes from Megan, Nicole, and everybody else. So thank you guys so much for the likes, the shares, the gifts. It's greatly appreciated. And if you aren't familiar with our schedule, we usually do every second and fourth Tuesday. That's going to be a little different with the holidays coming up, but hope you all have a wonderful night. And Ash, do you have any closing thoughts for everybody?
Nope, sorry, I think I interrupted. No, that's okay. I was just like, okay, bye everybody. I am totally out of it. Sorry for the dog in the background.
Just no worries.
It was Tuesdays. Really stoked. I think it'll be great to catch up with the anthology short story that you have written in 2 weeks' time, Brandon.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about it.
Definitely.
But yeah, that's all I've got.
Okay. Well, as always, thanks, Ash, for being such a wonderful co-host. Thanks, everybody, for joining, and we will catch you guys next time.
Bye, everybody. See you later.
See ya.